Some people in Champaign are still cleaning up after this weekend's storms.
You could just see it like roll through the neighborhood, this big, just like a wall of wind. I don't know how else to describe it. It was kind of dusty and dirty and full of stuff.
That's Sue Gray describing the storm to the Champaign News Gazette. We talk about tornado safety and awareness. Last week, Governor Bruce Rauner signed into law a $38.5 billion spending plan for the state of Illinois. How are Illinois healthcare providers affected by this budget? What does it mean for them to finally have a full state budget, unlike in past years? We'll talk about that. But first,
she told me that in this study that they just completed, I am not even going to have chemo.
That's Teresa Durth speaking on CBS Chicago. She joins us along with her Loyola doctor, one of the authors of this new landmark cancer study. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Now that Governor Rauner has signed his first full budget since 2015, we thought today we would check in to see how Illinois healthcare providers will fare under this $38.5 billion spending plan. And some folks in Champaign are cleaning up after this weekend's storms, which did include two tornadoes. We thought this was a good time to remind everybody listening throughout the state to make sure they've got their storm safety plans ready. That will all be coming up later this hour. But first, we all know how scary cancer can be. Those of you who are regular listeners know about my breast cancer diagnosis last year. So I can say from personal experience, I was thrilled to see new groundbreaking research about breast cancer that was just presented in Chicago at this year's American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting. Some patients who are now diagnosed early with breast cancer will be able to avoid having to undergo chemotherapy completely thanks to this new study, which was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And one of the co-authors of the national team is from Loyola Medicine and on the line with us now. Dr. Kathy Albane is director of Loyola's Breast Clinical Research Program, as well as co-director of the Multidisciplinary Breast Oncology Center. Dr. Albane, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much, and good morning.
Good morning. I also wanted to bring on two women who have been working closely with Dr. Albane. Teresa Durth is a patient of Dr. Albane's getting treatment from breast cancer. She joins us from Coal City, Illinois, which is about an hour and a half southwest of Chicago. Jennifer Mall is on the line with us from Downers Grove, a suburb on the southwest side, and she was a participant in this study. Jennifer, Teresa, thank you for being with me as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Dr. Albane, I want to start with you. This research wouldn't necessarily prevent chemotherapy for everyone who's diagnosed with breast cancer, but how many patients do you all expect will now be able to avoid or bypass chemotherapy thanks to the findings of this research study?
Well, if you look at the most common subtype of breast cancer diagnosed in this country per year, and this study applies to those women, so estrogen receptor positive, lymph node negative, HER2 receptor negative. So that group, the most common type diagnosed, comprises about 100, 125,000 women per year, that new diagnoses. And of those, about 65 to 70,000 can avoid chemotherapy just because of the results of this study.
And can you
a huge number.
That's a huge number. Can you let us know a little bit more about what the findings were?
Sure. So back several decades ago, we learned that even though the breast cancer tumor had not spread to the lymph nodes under the arm, you still could have a recurrence over time, and that's because the tumors could escape through the cells, could escape through the lymph nodes into the bloodstream and hide in the organs such as liver, lungs, brain, and then cause trouble over time, 5, 10 years, even 20 years after diagnosis. So we did studies showing that chemotherapy could avoid a lot of those late or early recurrences and increase cures. So back then, the pendulum swung toward giving a lot of almost all women with lymph node negative breast cancer chemotherapy. Then along came the understanding that one size doesn't fit all, so to speak, for these tumors, because the biology, even though they all have estrogen receptor on the tumor and no HER2 receptor, there's still a heterogeneity or difference among these tumors. and a 21 gene test was developed, which showed that there was a range of scores. These scores, this test assesses 21 genes from the breast cancer biopsy to determine how active they are and is assigned a score called a recurrence score from 0 to 100. So we learned a number of years ago, over 10 now, that if you have a very low score on this test, your tumor, you can avoid chemotherapy below 11, say, and if anything over 25, you definitely have an increased chance of recurrence and benefit from chemo. But in the middle, we didn't know what to do, so between 11 and 25, and that's what this study addressed. And Jennifer, who's on this call, one of my patients, was one of many who agreed to be assigned by a computer to get chemotherapy or not to determine over time then following women whether or not they needed the chemo. And bottom line result, as you alluded to in your opening remarks, is chemotherapy does not benefit women below a score of 25.
And Jennifer,
they can avoid it.
Yeah, so Jennifer, you were in that medium group then.
Yes, yes. I had a recurrence score of 17, so kind of smack dab in the middle.
And, I mean, I know how hard these decisions are at the time, right? Because you are thinking about, they're talking to you, doctors are talking to you about treatment options, and you're thinking about the rest of your life, and you, how hard was it for you, first of all, to decide to be a part of the study?
Well, it was extremely hard. I was 39. I was young. I had three small children, a three-year-old, a five-year-old, and a seven-year-old. Other than the breast cancer, I was very healthy. I, you know, as I mentioned, I was young, and the thought of chemotherapy really scared me. At Dr. Albane, I was so fortunate to have her kind of guiding me through all of this, and she mentioned this study. I did have the Oncotype test performed on my biopsy, and, you know, I felt, as I mentioned, fell in this recurrence score of 17 in the middle. And there wasn't the data to back up, you know, a certain treatment for me. So it was difficult making that decision. I didn't want to not do the chemo and then have it come back, or I didn't want to do the chemo unnecessarily. So I kind of had decided in my head I wasn't ready to do the chemo, and Dr. Albane kind of said, well, why don't you sign up for this study, get it randomized, see what you get. And I was assigned to the non-chemo group, so it was great to be part of that.
And was it, did you worry, though, until the study came out that maybe that might have been the wrong decision?
Yes, and Dr. Albane can attest to that because I asked her continually, are the results ready, are the results ready? Yeah, and your mind plays tricks on you, so for a couple years after that, you know, I always thought, did I do the right thing?
Every time you get sick, sure, you think.
Right, every time I got sick, it was, is the cancer spreading? Is it, you know, in my lungs now? So, yeah, it definitely was, you know, a struggle mentally to kind of get over and convince myself that, you know, it's okay. So seeing these results, it was a really good feeling that I was able to be part of such such exciting data.
Yeah, really groundbreaking research, as we're talking about with one of the study participants, Jennifer Mall, who's on the line with us from Downers Grove, and someone who will now benefit from this, which is Teresa Durth. Teresa, you started seeing Dr. Albane in May, I understand. At that point, did you know whether or not you might have to consider chemotherapy as an option?
Well, I wasn't 100% sure if I was going to have chemotherapy at up until I had the discovery on the 11th of May. I thought it was just a benign tumor that was just going to be taken out. And then after I saw, I'm sorry, that was 11th of April, when I saw Dr. Albane, Dr. Smick is the one who did my surgery and referred me to Dr. Albane. And once I found out that my Oncotype score was a 16, I then was going to have to make the decision of, because I fell right into that smaller group.
Right, that intervening group we've been talking about.
Right, and I definitely was going to go with the chemotherapy because I have an aunt who is in her 80s, and she is now fighting cancer. And I did not want to have any type of a
a recurrence.
Recall of
mm-hmm.
cancer
yeah.
If I could prevent it now. But on the 18th, Dr. Albane had said that there was a study that was going to be coming out, and she really didn't want me to make my decision until then. So I had all kinds of hopes that it was going to be in my favor, and thankfully it was. And I really want to thank every single woman that was brave enough to do such an astounding study, because it really benefited patients like myself, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so Jennifer, that's one of the people that she is mm-hmm. thanking you. Teresa's
yes.
thanking you. Dr. Albane, I wonder, yes. when we think about these findings now as an oncologist, what is it like to be able to present this to patients like Teresa and say, we have pretty clear research on this. We don't think you have to go through chemotherapy.
Well, I think what you can say is for countless women, like you've just heard from, as well as their medical oncologists, such as myself, our days of uncertainty are over. It's just incredibly exciting that in some women we can de-escalate therapy now, where a month ago we might have given it, and others we are certain with very low scores we were doing the right thing. And then for those with scores over 25, they can feel more confident about it's the right decision to do chemotherapy. And then, of course, we have great ways of avoiding side effects now that we didn't used to have. So we can tailor our treatments to everyone. And the mnemonic for the trial comes out, Taylor X, and indeed that's what we're doing. We now have a more perfect fit of our prescriptions for these women, so to speak, from this study.
Right. And as certainly someone who went through chemotherapy, I can say it is terrible. And if you do not have to go through it, it would be good to not. And you heard Teresa and Jennifer describe how they were thinking about this. I wonder from your perspective as a doctor, in addition to, as you said, of course, there's medications to alleviate the side effects. If it's necessary, it's necessary. Do you think this, it does seem from this research now, though, that this is something that we can now know it was maybe a little overprescribed?
Well, you have to remember that what we were going on was one small study, and as Teresa will tell you and Jennifer, there are error bars around that chemotherapy benefit, and for Teresa, there might have been a 2-3% absolute benefit to chemotherapy from the initial studies with the oncotype tests. And women see that differently. You put 100 women in a room, and some will choose the chemo and some will not. I wouldn't say it's overprescribed. I mean, the visits we've had with women over the decade Oncotype's been available for these intermediate scores have been very lengthy doctor's visits, and we go through the pros and the cons in great depth. It's just not that women, way back when, yes, chemotherapy was overprescribed before Oncotype came along. And I would not say now in the last decade it's been thoughtfully prescribed, but now we can omit that recommendation in many more women than just the ones with the scores below 11. So now we've increased the number that we can feel confident about not giving the woman the choice of to take it or not take it.
I wanted to end by asking Jennifer and Teresa, both of you, Dr. Albane, thanks for that perspective. I appreciate it. Jennifer, for anyone listening who's about to start the process of breast cancer treatment, Jennifer, what advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, I'm just really happy that so many women can avoid that uncertainty if they are in that range, because, you know, it was, like I mentioned earlier, it was really difficult to make that decision. But, you know, I would suggest kind of do your research, listen to your oncologist. You know, I was fortunate to have Dr. Albane as my doctor, and she really was on the up-and-coming, you know, research and knew how to or what to prescribe in the Oncotype DX test. But get all the facts, and you know, you'll be okay. I know several women had told me that at the time, and it was hard for me to swallow that, but I had to get my head wrapped around that I was going to be okay.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jennifer. A lot of people told me that, and I didn't believe that. And now I can say, you are okay. I'm okay. You're okay. Teresa, right. What about you? What advice do you have for your newly diagnosed? So I know this is very new for you.
Well, I think that you should always go with your gut feeling. If wherever you're going or whoever you're seeing, if you don't feel that what they're going to be prescribing to you, question it and, you know, always make sure that you understand everything. And another thing is I know that I'm about an hour and a half away from Dr. Albain, but don't let travel make your choice of decision of your doctor or where you're going to take your treatments or anything like that, because when you think about it, that's such a short part of your life to make sure that everything ongoing in your life is going to be perfect. So, you know, I just go with your gut feelings and don't let travel be your choice of where you're going to go see somebody. And always believe in miracles because they are there.
Thanks for that, Teresa. Dr. Albain, any final advice for women who are listening?
No, I just want everyone to understand how important it is that your tax dollars support clinical research, because we wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for all the pieces that go together to mount such a large trial. Countless numbers of experts, the National Cancer Institute, the company that made the Oncotype test that provided it for women who could not otherwise pay for the test through their insurance, and last but not least, the patients, the advocates that are out there. There are many lay advocates involved on our steering committee for this trial from the get-go, so that everything from a patient's perspective was taken into account, and then patients such as my two here, multiplied by thousands around the country who face this diagnosis every year.
Yeah.
Now
well, thank
you've got
you
some great data.
We do. And thank you for your, all of you, for your participation. Dr. Albain with Loyola, Teresa Dearth, and Jennifer Mall. Ladies, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for doing the story.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Governor Bruce Rauner signed into law a $38.5 billion spending plan for the state of Illinois. It's the first time he's approved a full year-long budget since taking office in 2015. Just a reminder, last time around, we had a two-year budget impasse that was only resolved after members of Governor Rauner's own party voted to override his budget vetoes. And for the past 3 years, the healthcare industry has been feeling the effects of all of that uncertainty, as well as the impasse and the reduced amount of state resources and funding, especially when it comes to addiction treatment providers. Today, we thought we'd ask, what impact did the budget crisis have on Illinois healthcare providers, and what does it mean to them now to finally have a new state budget? In a few minutes, we're going to be checking in with Sarah Howe, who's CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. But first, I'm joined on the line by Tim Stumm. He's editor of Health News Illinois. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, Tim, when we think about the past 3 years of budget crisis, what impact has this uncertainty, this kind of start and stop funding when it did happen, had on what has it had on the healthcare industry?
Well, I think the kind of just the uncertainty in addition to the decreased funding certainly has had an impact on providers and their ability to provide care and the care that they can provide. So I think there was certainly a lot of praise and kind of good feelings that came from this last budget, which was a pretty different process than some recent budgets, in addition to some increased funding in some certain areas, just the kind of optimism and kind of the bipartisan nature that marked this budget is something that, you know, has been noted by many people in the healthcare industry.
And as we're thinking about what's in this budget, I wonder if we can delve into some specifics. There's everything to from more funding to poison control centers to caregivers working with disabled adults getting a raise. Let's just talk about what you're seeing in terms of overall some highlights of healthcare and funding for this budget.
Yeah, yes. Like you said, there's certainly a lot in this budget. It's an over 1,200-page document, and there's also some pieces of legislation that weren't specifically part of the budget, but were passed kind of in tandem with the budget. So just some kind of highlights that stick out, I think, from folks that I've talked to, really the thing that kind of sticks out most is actually what was not in this budget, and that was a 4% rate cut for Medicaid to providers, which was initially proposed by Governor Rauner when he unveiled his initial budget proposal earlier in the year. And there was certainly some concern and fear amongst providers that if this was the starting point for these negotiations, there was some fear on kind of what that would lead to. So those cuts were restored in the final budget that was signed by the governor.
And Tim, can I just ask you about that Medicaid? We know that when we look at reimbursement rates in Illinois, they're generally pretty low. What would that have meant had those cuts gone through? As it stands right now, how are we looking with the way that we're funding Medicaid?
Well, yeah, I think that they are among the lowest in the country, and so there was concern that to cut those rates even further would have a pretty big impact, and the impact was spread across a variety of different providers, and so it would impact different providers differently. But yeah, there was certainly concern that already low rates would be cut even further. I think there is still certainly a lot of praise that and happiness that those cuts were restored, but yes, that is certainly also kind of comments we've heard since the budget has been passed that that's great. These cuts were restored, but there still also is a lot of work to be done to work on rates and then get them back at a level that providers believe would really help improve care further in the state.
We also talked in the past on the 21st about independent pharmacies. There was some concern from different independent pharmacies, and they were asking for some relief for the state when it comes to their reimbursement rates. Was that resolved?
I guess you would say it was. It included in the budget was some increased funding for small independent pharmacies. There had been concern that as part of the state's big expansion of managed care for Medicaid, that cuts that were being decreases in funding for pharmacies, that part of that process were going to be pretty hard to absolve from these smaller, more rural pharmacies. And so there is some increased funding for those types of pharmacies that was included in this spending plan that was signed by the governor.
So apart from Medicare, we mentioned one of these smaller parts of the plan having to do with independent pharmacies. What else stands out to you when we look at what's about to be implemented?
Sure. Some other kind of things that stick out from the budget, and I'll just kind of list some of the highlights. There's certainly a lot in there. There wasn't a lot of huge ticket items, but there was a lot of kind of little things that that people did kind of express some optimism about. You mentioned the increased funding for the independent pharmacy. Some other things that were included was an increase in wages for frontline caregivers who work primarily with developmentally disabled adults. There is a requirement that Medicaid cover preventative dental services for adults. This has been a big priority of dentists and the Dental Association for several years. There is some stuff in there that addresses a backlog of bills for long-term care facilities. There's been concern that Medicaid determinations are not getting processed by required deadlines. This is actually an issue that's presently working itself out through the courts as well, but this proposal puts in statute some language that essentially requires the state to start determining determine if they're eligible, these recipients are eligible for Medicaid on a more timely basis and start paying for some of these bills for some of these long-term care facilities for some of the care that they provided.
It also restores some funding for addiction treatment and community mental health. And I wonder, as we hear so many, particularly lawmakers, talk about, for example, our opioid epidemic, what does it look like in this budget in regards to that?
Yep. So that's a great point. Yep. So this also, in addition to this, these rate cuts to Medicaid, the governor's initial budget proposal, when he unveiled it, it includes some cuts to a handful of human services programs. And so those have been restored as well in the package that was signed. So that is funding for programs like addiction and community mental health, as well as epilepsy, autism, youth employment, and so things like that.
That's Tim Stumm. He's editor of Health News Illinois, giving us a sense of some of the specifics of how healthcare and healthcare providers will be affected by this new spending plan that will take effect soon. Tim, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
As we talk about particularly substance abuse providers, I wanted to bring another voice into the conversation. Sarah Howe is CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. They represent more than 60 healthcare providers across Illinois. She's on the line with us now from Springfield. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
So, Sarah, as we were just talking to Tim about initially Governor Rauner proposing some cuts, those did not happen for substance abuse treatment and for mental health services. What are we looking at in terms of the budget? I believe there's a 3% rate increase for substance abuse treatment and a permanent 3% rate increase for mental health services, which we first saw last year. Is that sufficient funding for your providers?
Well, first, you've got it right. There are those increases that are in there. One is a 3% increase for addiction providers, and then the annualization of last year's 3% increase for mental health. We're certainly very pleased, but to answer your second question, it does not cover the cost of services. Our rates, as you heard Tim mention, for all of healthcare are really far below the cost of doing business. So we're talking upwards of 40 to 50% differential between what it costs to provide the services and the current rates that we get in the state.
Wow. And so how does Illinois still rank when it comes to other states in terms of how much it's funding substance abuse? It sounds like not great.
Not great. I believe the last time I looked, we were in the bottom third. Things shift and change all the time, but we certainly have a ways to go, particularly in that rate setting. That's where the biggest challenge comes in, is in our rates. And obviously, when rates don't cover the cost of care, then we're not able to serve the same number of people that we need to year in and year out.
And when rates don't cover the cost of care and you're not able to serve that same number of people, how does that affect not just those individual lives, but the system and taxpayers in general?
It's a great question. We all pay when people don't get the services that they need. If they can't get into treatment today, that does not mean that they will even come back tomorrow, particularly when somebody is in crisis, whether that's a mental health crisis, an addiction crisis. We need to be able to get them into services right away. If they do not get into services when they knock on the door and ask for them, they're likely to wind up in either the hospital emergency department. They often wind up on the streets. We do see them, unfortunately, in our criminal justice system. You hear a lot of folks that work within our criminal justice system saying that the individuals that they see in county jails particularly are there as a result of mental health or addiction. So we're really not serving people in the best place where they can be served.
And Sarah, during the budget crisis, we talked about how particularly devastating that was for addiction treatment providers. This was a time when the state had no spending plan at all, while needs for these services were increasing. Where do things stand now? In particular, with this budget, there's a rate increase. We talked to Tim about measures of stability. Do you have a sense now that there's first, let's just start with, is there stability now within the system for funding?
I think there is a little bit more stability. Tim mentioned earlier that just having a budget going into July 1st, knowing where we're going to be, knowing that there are no cuts coming, and recognizing that there is a small increase for rates is really important. Our providers can start planning. They can get their budgets in place. They know that they can retain the staff that they have. They know that they can retain the case levels that they need right now. Are they able to get to everybody? No. I mean, particularly when we're talking about an opioid crisis, the increasing amount of suicides that we see in Illinois is one that I believe our suicide rates have gone up around 25% in the past year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing significant crises in Illinois. Are we going to be able to get all of those individuals in the door based on this budget? We're not. But what we also know is we're likely not going to be closing doors. And that's an important piece of keeping the system stabilized and moving forward.
And when we think about doors that closed and have how many of those, I'm just wondering what the landscape looks like now. Are there providers that we know in some cases there are places that have been able to reopen or facilities that have now come and taken over? What does the landscape look like outside of Chicago for particularly treatment providers?
We have seen a couple of providers that have reopened or an agency has taken over within that service area. I think the biggest challenge we still see is where a provider has closed a certain level of service, particularly something like detox, where we do not have the rates to cover the cost. We are not necessarily seeing that we're throwing the doors wide open. We're able to provide a lot more detox services, for example, and that's just one example. But providers are trying to figure out where can they start adding services, looking at their budget, figuring out what the need is in their community too, and that's really critical. They're working to see who is knocking on their door for what level of service and how can we try to make those changes. So you're not seeing a major increase in programs, but you are seeing some planning based on this stability.
We're speaking with Sarah Howe, CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. As I mentioned, this organization represents more than 60 providers throughout the state. Sarah, what's your dream scenario for what the state of Illinois does for behavioral health? Is it mostly a drastic increase in funding?
I think it's an increase in funding, but I also don't believe that is all that it's going to take. Certainly, if we were to really look at treatment on demand, then we would be talking, we'd really have to change the way we budget and the way we take care of providers in this system. But I also think that there's bigger issues beyond just funding. Some of the work that we did this session was around parity with insurance and mental health coverage that's on par with medical and surgical coverage. That's important, too, that it's not just state-funded dollars, but that insurance, whether you're on insurance, whether you're on Medicaid, that you're getting the same level of coverage. So some of these things are policy changes that we need to have happen, and I'm really pleased that of the work that we did to really transform our parity law. Our parity law is now the strongest in the country. It is on the governor's desk for him to sign, so that's something that we're looking forward to as well, because it's not just dollars and cents. There are critical policy changes that need to come in place as well.
And it sounds like you have a sense that you think that's happening in Springfield now.
I do believe it is happening. The conversations that we had this past session were really positive. Everybody recognizes the need for strong mental health and substance abuse services. There is no doubt about it. Everybody I talked to could tell us what was going on in their district and how it related back to mental health and addiction services. So now it's putting all these pieces together, coming out from this budget crisis that we had. It's not going to change overnight. I think we've said that repeatedly on the program. But moving forward, what positive policies can we put into place, and how do we keep building on the budget that we have going forward so ultimately people can get access to services immediately? And that's the critical piece.
And Sarah, do you have a sense that some of the damage that was done over the past few years, was that irreparable in some cases?
Absolutely. In some cases, it absolutely was. There are people that could not get into services that did not survive. And in that case, there's nothing we can do about that now, except move forward and in their memory really try to make sure that never happens again.
Mm. Sarah, as you think about this, what you would like to see from lawmakers, especially now with this election year, it sounds like, what are you all working on next?
The key issue here is making sure that addiction to mental health is a priority in this state. We hear about it over and over. Last week is a great example. We heard about the suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, which are really high-profile individuals, yet we know every day in Illinois, you don't need to be a high-profile individual to be suffering. And from our policymakers, we need them to recognize that if we do not have that access to care, and I think that's the critical piece, the immediate access to care, whatever we do, we have to be focused on that so people can get in the door when they need the services that they're asking for. So that is always going to be our focus moving forward.
That's Sarah Howe, CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. Sarah, thanks for being with us. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned to the 21st. Coming up, there were two tornadoes that hit the Champaign-Urbana area yesterday. We're going to be joined by meteorologist Jeff Frame and the American Red Cross to talk about how you can be better prepared this summer. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you were in the central Illinois area on Sunday, then you know that we were hit with some pretty major storms, storms that were all over the state, but in central Illinois have now been confirmed as tornadoes. The National Weather Service confirmed that two tornadoes did touch down after 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. No one was injured, but the tornadoes did damage several homes in the Champaign area, and many more people lost power. We thought this was a good reminder for all of us throughout the state listening to have a reminder of different types of tornadoes, what to do when they're hit, to make sure your family has a safety plan in action. With us to do this on the line is CEO of the American Red Cross for the Central and Southern Illinois region, Lynn Horuska. Thanks for being with us, Lynn.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And in studio with me here in Urbana is meteorologist Jeff Frame, who also teaches at the University of Illinois Department of Atmospheric Sciences. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back.
Hi, Nyla. Great to be back.
So, Jeff, for listeners who weren't in the area, pretty much anywhere you were in Illinois on Sunday, you probably got rained on. But what kind of storm conditions did we see, particularly in the Champaign area on Sunday?
Right. Sunday was a pretty stormy day around here. We had some storms go through in the morning, and then a stronger line developed off to our northwest during the early afternoon hours. And as that came southeastward, there were a couple brief spin-up vortices we saw on radar along that line. I actually went out, did a little storm chasing Sunday afternoon. Don't do that unless you know what you're doing. And one of those vortices actually produced two brief tornadoes, unfortunately impacting some homes in southwestern Champaign around 2:15 Sunday afternoon. The Weather Service was out yesterday afternoon, did a survey of the damage, and confirmed that that was the result of two brief tornadoes, both lasting for less than a minute, with path lengths of only 0.1 miles. That's about 500
really
feet.
Really small.
Yeah, really small, and only about 20 to 30 yards wide. Maximum winds 80 to 85 miles an hour. So these were not the big, large wedge tornadoes that you see out on the plains that can last sometimes for an hour, but these are still very damaging if they happen to impact your house.
And remind us, if you can walk us through what is supposed to happen in terms of alarms and scenarios when a tornado, tornadoes are really fast. Oftentimes they come up very quickly. I don't even know if there was a tornado watch issued in this case, if we thought there was a possibility of this happening.
We were under a severe thunderstorm watch issued by the National Weather Service for Sunday afternoon. There were a couple tornado warnings around the area, one up near Bloomington, another one issued a little later on southeast of there along I-74, Farmer City, Mansfield, that area. Champaign itself was just outside of the border of that warning. But these things, like I said, they can spin up very, very fast looking at radar. Sometimes it can be, 30 seconds, a minute. And then by the time you see the circulation issue the warning, the thing's dissipated. So it's almost like a whack-a-mole problem with some of these little vortices that can spin up along these lines sometimes.
And so let's talk about alerting folks to situations like this. In this case, I saw some conversation on social media about the siren warning system. That's an older system, right? Like, I don't know. That's something I think, was that developed in the 60s? What is the point of that's the external siren system.
Right.
Is that something people should rely on?
Yeah, they're called outdoor warning sirens. And yeah, they date from the Cold War. Those of our older listeners remember, atomic bomb drills, and those same sirens would go off. And if, we were under threat of nuclear war, those same sirens would go off for that. So it's very old technology, but they're only meant to be heard outdoors. They're not meant to be heard inside, especially modern homes or more substantial structures. So if you're outdoors and you hear the sirens, you certainly want to go inside a substantial structure and take shelter. Also, the criteria for sounding those sirens varies from community to community. For example, here in Champaign, the sirens only sound if the emergency management officials who are in control of those get visual confirmation of a tornado or a developing tornado threatening Champaign. In Bloomington, they have that same criteria, but they will also sound the sirens if they believe there's a threat of 70-mile-an-hour straight-line wind gusts. So it varies from community to community. But really, in 2018, we should not be relying on outdoor sirens indoors. We have much better technology nowadays, including smartphones. You can download an app from FEMA that will alert you to weather warnings and other alerts, volcanoes and the like, if you happen to be in Hawaii, for your area, where you are, because your phone knows, based on GPS technology, where you are. And, of course, local radio and local television will break into programming and provide those warnings. Like I said, I do some storm chasing, and whenever I'm out chasing, I make sure to have on a local radio station so that I can hear the warnings coming over the radio if I do miss something on my phone or I don't have service or something like that.
Right. We're not just plugging our local public radio stations, but it is true. We do have a severe weather system, and that's an automated system where those emergency alerts will go out across all of this. So as the station you're listening to is always a good station to tune into if we know something's going on. Lynn, to that point about apps, I was just telling Jeff before we went on the air, I was in Chicago and driving back to Champaign, and I said to him, I didn't get an alert. And he said, yeah, because your phone knew where you were. What kind of recommendations do you have for folks in terms of smartphone apps and how to be alert before something happens?
Well, there are some great ones out there. American Red Cross actually offers free downloadable apps. You go to your own app store, Google Play, whichever, search American Red Cross, and there's a number of free apps available, including an emergency app. These apps will, you put in the zip codes that you want it to monitor for you, and then you will get real-time alerts about what's evolving in your area. You can not only monitor the area that you're in, and the GPS will do that for you, but if you have children in another state or you have friends or family traveling, you can also be monitoring the areas they're in, and you'll get those alerts to your phone.
We're talking with Lynn Horuska from the American Red Cross. She's CEO of the Central and Southern Illinois region. Jeff Frame, a meteorologist, is in studio with me here in Urbana. We're taking your questions, by the way. If you have questions about the storm, about weather, about storm preparedness, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. And you can tweet to us as well. Our handle is 21STShow. Jeff, I just wanted to ask you, we got a question on Twitter about safety. So we've covered sort of the alerts, how you could be alerted. If you are in a situation when a tornado, as we're saying, sometimes it comes up very quickly. We had a question from Anna on Twitter who's saying, growing up, we were told a bathtub is one of the safest places. But recently, I heard that's no longer true.
Bathtub is a good place to be. The best place to be is underground in a basement. But if you live in a house or an apartment without a basement, you want to seek shelter on an interior room on the lowest floor, be it the basement, be it the first floor. But you want to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible. Now, one reason why a bathtub is especially good, or a bathroom, is that the water pipes inside the walls strengthen those walls. But don't just seek shelter in the bathtub or in the basement. Put on a bike helmet if you have one. The point of those things is to protect your head. Another one, if it hits maybe as you're going to bed or maybe in the middle of the night, and for those middle of the night warnings, also NOAA weather radio, it's great to have one. You can program it. It can wake you up in the middle of the night where your phone or obviously TV won't do that. But put shoes on, because there's going to be, if you do get hit by a tornado or strong winds, there's going to be a lot of debris everywhere, and you don't want to be walking around without a good pair of shoes. People used to say hide under a table or some sturdy workbench. Really, you don't want to do that. What you want to do is hide under a mattress or blankets or something that'll cushion the impact. Because if a table or a heavy workbench falls on you, that's just not going to feel very good.
And Lynn, when we're thinking about storm safety plans for families and developing that, what do you suggest that families and other people, whoever they are in Illinois, as they're thinking about preparing for storms, what kind of plan do you, how do you suggest people prepare?
Well, we encourage people to plan ahead, first of all, to know where you'll go during inclement weather, a place that your household members and your pets will gather during a tornado. Which it could be a basement, a storm cellar, or an interior room. We also encourage that as you're looking for those places in the place to go in the building that you're in, that you, if you're in a high-rise building, you pick a hallway. Again, the center of the building will keep you safer than being where you're vulnerable to windows. And we also encourage those who live in mobile homes to choose a safe place when they hear those sirens or receive the alert to evacuate to. Basically, there's no area of a mobile home that's safe during a tornado, so we encourage people to leave the area for safety then.
And when we're thinking about getting information also, Jeff, how reliable is social media in situations like this? You're tweeting. I follow you on Twitter. You're a meteorologist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm going to be a journalist on social media and look at the sources. But what do you suggest that people do?
Yeah, you really want to follow a legitimate weather sources on social media. I find Twitter to be probably the best medium in getting things out and up to date.
All the National Weather Services.
The National Weather Service, Lincoln, Illinois, here in central Illinois, the Chicago office up in that area, the Quad Cities in northwest Illinois, St. Louis in southwest Illinois, in Paducah in southeast Illinois, in far southern Illinois. Those are your local offices. Also follow local broadcast meteorologists. But be careful of following, so-and-so's Extreme Weather Center, somebody you've never heard of. It's a free country. They can put out anything they want about blizzards or tornado outbreaks 8 days out. And a lot of times those things don't come to fruition. So you have to make sure the person actually knows what he or she is talking about. Facebook has some issues because if, for example, you post something on Facebook with the WILL account, it'll reach probably 5 to 10% of the fans of that page. And so that's a real problem with Facebook, just the way their algorithms work, in getting that message out.
Right. Facebook is a little bit more difficult because of the platform. Unless you're paying to advertise the post, it's hard to reach people. Lynn, we're thinking about the summer and storms. What other things do you suggest people do to prepare? We're thinking about the unfortunate couple dozen of folks who lost power. Is this a good time to go through some of those reminders for the summer as well? Right, Lynn?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We encourage people who are going to be out of doors to monitor the weather. Absolutely. Stay where you can hear those radio, all the latest information. But we encourage people who find themselves out and about and a storm comes up to be aware of the weather as it's changing, to seek shelter in, if you're outside during a storm or a storm approaching, to actually seek shelter. And if you cannot get to a shelter, to stay in your vehicle, put your seatbelt on, and keep your head below the window level in case there's flying debris.
And what are we thinking about in terms of preparing for power? Should folks just have things on hand? Growing up in South Florida, I feel like during hurricane season, everyone stocks up and you have water and batteries and those sorts of things. Do people in Illinois need to be as prepared?
Absolutely. We encourage everybody to have a kit or disaster preparedness kit wherever they're going to shelter in place. Having those things that you may need or need nearby you during a disaster like that. So having a flashlight with working batteries, having some water on hand, taking your safe papers with you so that in the event that your home is destroyed, you have access to your critical papers, keeping medications or at least some supply of your medications in that kit is critical as well. And of course, when you're sheltering with pets and kids, always think in terms of the things that you might need to have in hand if you're going to shelter in place for a few hours or the better part of the day, pet food, kids' toys, things that will be comforting and maybe needed during that time.
Jeff, we just have less than a minute left. Any other final advice for folks as we're thinking about this summer and storm season?
Finally, you mentioned you were driving back from Chicago on Sunday afternoon. So what do you do if you're in a car and severe weather happens? Well, when you get the alert, a car is not a safe place to be during a tornado. It offers great shelter from lightning, but during a tornado, cars are not safe. Seeking shelter under underpasses is not safe either. You can easily be blown out of there. So if you're in a car, first thing you want to do is find substantial shelter. But if you're really caught in the middle of nowhere, say on I-57 somewhere north of Champaign, you should be able to see what's going on and just floor it and get out of there. But don't do that in any kind of city, Chicago, Champaign, Peoria, any kind of decent city. Do not try to drive away from a tornado in your car. You'll just be caught in traffic and you'll lose visibility with buildings and trees.
That's Jeff Frame. You can follow Jeff on Twitter, Vortex Jeff, for more information on this. I want to thank Lynn Horuska for being with us as well with the American Red Cross. Both of you, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. We are a product of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day. Stay safe out there.